Well, Zubair gave a wonderful introduction to this talk, and so that may enable me to do this presentation in the 20 minutes. Okay, this is the title of the talk. I would normally not put, would not have placed my name on the title biograph. I am doing it this time because as of January 1st, I moved from Bell Labs to Columbia University. I do keep, at least I hope for the next 2 years, the laboratory at Bell Labs, and all this work has been done at Bell Laboratories with Brian Dennis, Lauren Pfeiffer, who with whom we collaborate in more than just making the samples. And Vittorio Pellegrini was, at the time of this work, was a student at the Scuola Normale in Pisa, and with Annette Plaut, who is a junior professor at Exeter University. Mark Erickson joins us about a year ago, and he has been doing some of the work. I will only have a few comments on Mark's work, because that would take, otherwise this is ongoing work, and otherwise it would take a lot of time. Basically, this is an elastic scattering experiment. There is an incident beam at frequency omega L. There is a scattered beam at frequency omega S. There are conservation rules. One of them is obviously conservation of energy, and the other one is the conservation of wave vector, which derives from the condition of conservation of momentum. But it's typical of the light scattering experiments we do that this condition breaks down, and that enables us to study phenomena which are at relatively large wave vector. Let me give you a brief outline of the talk. Basically, the idea was to give you a flavor of some of the recent work we have been doing. We measure the collective gap excitation of the state at one fractional quantum Hall state at 1/3 about 5 years ago, and since then, on and off, we have been trying to study excitations of the other states, particularly the 1/2/5. Those turn out to be difficult experiments. It is possible that in more recent work we should be able to see, or we are beginning to see, the collective modes of the state at 2/5, but this is work that actually is going on at this time. Mark Erickson and Brian Dennis are doing the measurements. The core of this talk is related to unstable modes in the quantum Hall regime. Unstable modes are modes of frequency, are soft modes, meaning their energies are well below the typical single particle energies, transition energies in the 2D electron gas, and on top of that, for some value of the sample parameters or parameters of experiments, the energy of these modes may go down to zero, and then the two-dimensional system becomes unstable and has a quantum phase transition. Some of the more recent work actually involves ultra-low density to this system. The densities are now as low as 10 to the 9 per square centimeter, and we can actually do measurements at those densities, and this is work also initiated with Mark Erickson and Lauren Pfeiffer, and I will only mention a few of the items associated with this work. One of them is the design of the samples. The idea here, of course, we want to study the stability of the system, possible quantum phase transitions, but we want to do it. This is supposed to be a color biograph. I mean, it has green and it has green and blue in it. But well, it does tell you that low density systems have quantum phase transitions.
Even
Okay, basically, I'm sorry, some of the contrast is lost here, but... Okay, so this is the guy... Can I get back like a half a minute? Okay, this is the gallium arsenide substrate. There is, as is usual in modulation doping samples, a buffer layer. Then there is the actual, this is a single quantum well, the schematics of the structure of the conduction, the bottom of the conduction band is shown here. Basically, this is the first layer of the barrier, this is the top layer of the barrier, and this is the quantum well. There's a doping layer somewhere in there, in the top barrier layer. And in order to preserve the quality of the two-dimensional system at very low densities, we use first, these are samples designed jointly with Lauren Pfeiffer, we first drop the concentration of aluminum. That makes a better, for one thing, that will make a better interface at the quantum well, and on top of that, we require that for the transfer of the low densities of charge in the case of modulation doping. And very far out here, several thousand angstroms away from the gallium arsenide quantum well, we have the conventional silicon doping layer to produce the low density. Now, one of the difficulties with this sample is because the layer is so far from the doping layer is so far, typically several thousand angstroms, so far from the gallium arsenide quantum well, the conductivity in the sample is very difficult to measure when you drop the density below 10 to the 10 per square centimeter. So it turns out that we can actually measure the density by studying the dispersive plasma excitation of this two-dimensional electron gas. And that is what we do, one of the things we do in a light scattering experiment. So we plot here the energy of the plasmon, and these are the typical data for a sample with for this sample actually, 1.2 times 10 to the 10, as a function of a scattering wave vector. And the scattering wave vector is changed by changing the geometry of the scattering experiment in such a way that there's an incidence angle of the incident and scattered beams, and that is related to the scattering wave vector by this relation, and this is the wavelength of the incident laser beam. So when you do plot the position of the plasma excitation as a function of the square root of the wave vector, you get something which is very close to a linear relation. And from the slope of that line, assuming the conventional square root dependence for the frequency as a function of the wave vector, you actually, the only parameter you don't know is the density. So out of that plot, you get the density in the two-dimensional system. What this experiment tells you is something else. It tells you that because the system responds with well-defined dispersive plasma excitation, it tells you that even at densities as low as 3.7 times 10 to the 9, the two-dimensional electron gas doesn't seem to show significant effects of localization. The current experiments are actually explored a lower density regime, as low as 10 to the 9. What Mark finds is that by time he's at a density of 10 to the 9, he has a substantial broadening of the plasmon line. There's another effect here. Mark believes that in these experiments, as you move to large wave vectors, there is a departure of the measured energies from strict linearity. And he believes this is due to exchange correlation effects. Another feature of this data is because the densities are so low, the wave vector in a scattering experiment actually becomes very close to the Fermi wave vector. So I will stop here and change to the main subject of this talk. Let me show you some, before I turn to unstable modes, let me show you typical data we now get for the fractional quantum Hall effect, collective excitation at filling factor of one-third. What we do now is we have here the scattering geometry, and we can now place a finite wave vector in the plane of the layer. So under those conditions, we find the way the experiment is done is that we change the incident, the frequency of the incident laser beam by tiny amounts, and anything that is luminescence in the data, when you plot the data as scattering, anything that is luminescence will shift. When you have a scattering feature, that feature will remain at a constant energy shift. So this feature here is clearly a scattering peak, and the other peaks here are luminescence. Now this is the peak that we assign to a long wavelength collective excitation of the quantum Hall state. The other peaks are the main luminescence from gallium arsenide. Now gallium arsenide is a very strong emitter of light, which is telling us now that the peak of the fractional quantum Hall effect is can be in intensity comparable to the intensity of the luminescence. Now an example like this is the one that we are pursuing the study of the state at 2/5. So let me go back to the main topic of the talk. This is the study of unstable modes and quantum phase transitions. Now the idea of this work, the reason we initiated the work, has to do with the fact that it's a basic feature, a major feature of the theories of the states in the integer and quantum Hall regime is the existence of a Rotem minimum in the dispersion of the collective excitation. This is the case of the magneto-Rotem mode at a state of 1/3. Now, if you, we believe, I mean, the theory, at least many people in this room would believe, that as you decrease the filling factor, this curve will go down. And eventually, at a filling factor of maybe 1/7 or 1/9, the Rotem minimum will touch—I mean, the Rotem minimum will touch zero—and the system will go unstable and develop perhaps a crystal, Wigner crystal state. Now, actually, it turns out that in a light scattering experiment, you can measure the Rotem minimum. The difficulty is that it's very difficult to go to a filling factor of 1/7. I mean, we have not succeeded in doing that. Now the physics of the Rotem minimum is actually is almost intuitive. It has to do with the fact that all these excitations are based on neutral particle or quasi-particle Hall pairs. There is between the in the neutral pair a binding energy between the excited electron state and the Hall left behind, and the effect, the impact of this binding energy, called very often in this room, it will be called perhaps a vertex correction term. Wait, what? So it's the impact of this vertex correction term on the dispersion will depend on the other terms that come into the dispersion, but typically it has to do with the wave vector dependence of the vertex correction. Now, as I said, the idea was to start with the... studying this thing is actually very difficult because we cannot go to low filling factors. But what we did a couple of years ago was to go to double layers at filling factor 1. For double layers at filling factor 1, so there are several theories that state that there is an instability in which the quantum Hall state at nu equals 1 would disappear. This has been actually first discovered in experiments done by, I believe, Greg Bovinger and then Jim Eisenstein. And the theories predict that that instability is related to a Rotem minimum in the dispersion of charge density excitations across the tunneling gap. So we actually, with Greg and to some extent with Jim, we started studying those samples, but we encountered a number of difficulties. So what happens is we knew that states at filling factor 2 may also develop instabilities, and that goes back to work done by Alan MacDonald in 1985. He has shown these are the dispersion of inter-lambda level excitations, excitations in which you change the lambda level quantum number. And the top curve has to do with charge density excitation. The lower one has to do with the spin excitations, and he calculates that there is a very pronounced Rotund minimum that depends on density. In fact, it depends on the R sub S value in the 2D system. Now, actually, it turns out that we had measured this Rotund minimum, and the Rotund minimum exists, but didn't at the time show the instability, didn't show an instability at the densities predicted by Allen. And the reason for that is that if you include the finite, the effect of the finite width of the wave function along the perpendicular direction, that minimum is actually greatly reduced. Actually, Mark Erickson, in his most recent experiments, discovered that there is a soft Rotund minimum at nu equals 2 when you go to samples of very low densities, because the magnetic field of nu equals 2 is quite low at those densities. I mean, that the impact of the electron-electron interaction is enhanced. So anyhow, 2 years ago we didn't know about this, and we decided to turn to double layers. And this is a typical Raman spectrum that you measure in a double quantum well. So this is the schematics of the double quantum well. This is the symmetric state. This is the anti-symmetric state, and they are separated by a single particle tunneling gap. Now, when you do measure the spectrum at zero magnetic field, it turns out that we measure two different components. They have to do with spin. They have to do with polarization of the incident and scattered light. Now, the polarization of the incident and scattered light are related to the helicity of the photons, and any change in polarization will give you are correlated with changes in angular momentum in the 2D electron system. So when you measure what we call a depolarized spectrum, which means incident and scattered polarizations are orthogonal to each other, while you're measuring spin, because you change the helicity of the two photons, then what you're measuring is a spin excitation. Now, in measurement where the incident and the scattered polarizations are parallel, what you're measuring is a charge density excitation, in the sense that there is no change, presumably there is no change in the spin degree of freedom of the system. So what you measure here, what we measure here, are the tunneling excitations across the tunneling gap. This is the charge mode at a higher energy, and this is the spin mode at a lower energy. In between, we can also measure what we call a single particle excitation. That's the one in which the particle hole pair in the excitations are not really correlated either by an excitonic binding or by what is called in 2D physics the depolarization effect. So if you are naive about this data, you say, well, if I now, because the spin density excitation happens to be at an energy lower than the single particle, than the energy of the single particle tunneling gap, then if you decrease the tunneling gap, eventually this thing is going to hit zero, and the system may go unstable. Well, that naive idea doesn't work, and the reason it doesn't work is because you need a finite density of charge, and here's the Fermi energy. If your Fermi energy is much larger than the tunneling gap, basically you have no phase space for those excitations, and then there is no excitonic binding, and this can actually be quantified by writing the energy or the spin density excitation that comes out of sort of linear response theory, and there is a phase factor. You have the difference in population between the symmetric and anti-symmetric state. So it doesn't work. So what you have to, but that gives you the idea that maybe you can actually induce an unstable collective mode by playing with the occupation numbers. And if you fix the density, you play with the occupation numbers by placing a magnetic field. Because the magnetic field, because of the degeneracy of the lambda levels, the magnetic field is going to remove some of the restrictions imposed by the Pauli principle. And that's exactly what we did. So we took that same sample, applied the magnetic field, and the magnetic field is plotted here as the inverse of the filling factor. The top part of the figure is a data for the charge density excitations. The lower part are for the spin density modes. And then you can see that you start with an energy for the spin mode, which is about half a millivolt. by the time you are at the filling factor of 2, and this is the low magnetic field, the energy has dropped by a factor of 3. Not only does it drop in energy, but it becomes very sharp. That's the way the width, full width at half maximum of the mode, changes as a function of magnetic field, and there is this minimum in width at the filling factor of 2. This is the inverse of the filling factor, so filling factor of 2 is roughly here. There's a tremendous sharpening of that spin density peak. It tells you that the original width of the peak is doesn't seem to be related to inhomogeneous effects, but it's rather an intrinsic property. So these are the data taken in that sample. And what you see in a scattering experiment, you have a Stokes site where actually the photon, the incident, the system, the two-dimensional system receives energy from the photon field, and there's an anti-Stokes side where the photons actually gain energy and they receive it from the 2D system. The radiation intensity between the Stokes and anti-Stokes side is a measure of the electron temperature, so we have a built-in thermometer in the experiment. So what we do the experiment, what you see here is the effect of the incident power. I mean, when you do the experiment with 10 microwatts, you get a real anti-Stokes signal that gives you an electron temperature of 0.9 degrees. I mean, the sample is, the bath is at 0.2 degrees, so it's a real heating of the electrons by the laser beam. Now, when you drop the power to 5 microwatts, the electron temperature is now 0.6, about 0.6 degrees. And lower temperatures, we really don't, in an experiment like this, we don't have the sensitivity to detect less heating, but our experiments are done with typical temperatures of about one microwatt. So having seen that tremendous softening of the spin mode excitation of this bilayer at filling factor of 2, what we did is to change the density. So if you have a higher density, at a density of 6.2 times 10 to the 10, you measure this mode. At a density of 9 times 10 to the 10, you measure that the energy of that mode has even lower energy. Now, it's actually a pretty low energy. It's only 45 microvolts. And basically, we are able to see it because the samples are extremely good and the peaks are very sharp. But what is relevant here is that the energy of this peak is very close to the Zeeman energy of the two-dimensional electron gas. Now, to interpret that and to try to convince you that this is related to a phase transition, I may need a minute to look into neutral particle excitation. We are at state nu equals 2, presumably a spin unpolarized state. The ground state has a two orientational spins. We make particle Hall excitations. The triplet state, there's a singlet and a triplet state made, constructed with these two, with that pair. And it turns out that in a light scattering experiment, when you look at the triplet, you see spin density excitations, which are the JZ, total angular momentum, equal to zero component of that triplet. And that is significant because if you look at the energies here, if you look at the splitting, the spin density state, the state with J sub Z equal to zero, has an energy which is equal to the tunneling gap energy in principle at that, for that or the energy of that excitation, which is actually, because the JZ equals zero state doesn't have a correction due to the Zeeman splitting. If you measure a spin density state that gets close to the energy, to the Zeeman energy, it means there has to be a low energy mode with J sub Z equals to 1, namely you flip the spin in the triplet, that has to have almost zero energy. So the fact that we observe a spin density mode which has an energy that approaches the Zeeman energy means there has to be a low energy mode which has almost zero energy. And indeed, if you actually measure, if you represent the data as the energy as a function of magnetic field, at the lowest temperature, as the mode energy approaches the Zeeman energy, and the dotted line here, the dashed line, is the way the German energy for a G factor of 0.4. Then as we approach nu equals 2 and the mode approaches an energy of Ez, we suddenly see the disappearance of the mode. We no longer can measure it in the spectrum. But as we raise the temperature, we go from 0.25 Kelvin to a temperature of, say, 1.2 Kelvin, we can actually study the curve in its full glory. I mean, we have a minimum in the energy very close to nu equals 2, but the peak is well defined at all temperatures. The way it disappears in the spectra shown here, the lower spectrum is the one measured. This is the magnetic field is 198, which is a field, nominal field of nu equals 2. And at 0.27 degrees, the spectrum is flat. At 0.7 degrees, we recover the peak. And that is a strong indication of a phase transition in the system. Now, at that point, that was the time where we published the first paper. I think that the work by Shankar Dasarma and his group, they pointed out that this is an indication of a Kosterlitz-Tauless phase transition in the system. But for us, from the point of view of experiment, what we wanted to do is to confirm that indeed there was a phase transition in the system. And this is some of the significant evidence. These are data. What we did is now we are turning the sample in the magnetic field while keeping the filling factor constant. And what that does is that the total magnetic field for staying at that value of filling factor has to increase. As you increase the magnetic field, what you have is an increase in the Zeeman energy. And there is, in these electron bilayers, as Subir mentioned before, there's this interplay between the interaction among the layers and the impact of the Zeeman energy. So at some point, you may expect something to happen. So these are the data taken for zero angle, and we have that a filling factor of 2.8. We have a well-defined mode associated with spin density excitations. As we increase the magnetic field and approach filling factor of 2, that the intensity of that mode disappears. Now, we do the same, which is what we believe it is the phase transition. If we increase the angle to 45 degrees, that is a substantial increase in magnetic field for this, for keeping the values of the filling factor constant, we have a completely different behavior. First of all, at 2.8, we have a well-defined peak, but it's now broader. At nu equals 2, the peak does not disappear, but it still stays there. And what we find at 45 degrees, that if we study the mode that we find in the light scattering spectrum as a function of magnetic fields, there are no substantial, there are no discontinuities, no behaviors like the ones found before at smaller angles. At nu equals 2, we find a peak that has a slight blue shift, actually, when approaching nu equals 2. But other than that, it blends sort of continuously with the peak we describe as a spin wave. That's the spin wave is the mode in which the only degree of freedom that changes is the orientation of spin, and there's no other change in the mode. So what we found then is that at 45 degrees, except for this anomaly, which we don't understand yet, what we have is that in the spectrum is dominated by scattering from spin waves. And what that means, you have spin waves, it's very simple to understand, that spin waves exist in a spin-polarized system. In other words, a ferromagnet will have spin waves. But an unpolarized system, like the one we started with at zero angle, would not have spin waves. So this system has undergone a transition to a different spin state from an unpolarized state to a polarized state. And what it means, basically, is that this is what these spectra are telling us. At small angles, the system is in an unpolarized state, but it develops this anomaly associated with the existence of a zero energy excitation. For large angles, the system is in a spin polarized state that has spin waves as the dominant excitation. On the basis of data like that, we were able to construct a phase diagram for nu equals 2. We employed for that phase diagram three samples and use the feeding factors of 2 and 6, which are the ones that display this type of phenomena. This is basically, the phase diagram shows the total magnetic field on one axis and the tunneling gap, which is a way of classifying the samples and also the strength of interlayer interactions. And these are for, this is the unpolarized phase, this is the spin polarized phase, and we call in the middle, in between those two, a phase which is characterized by the disappearance of a light scattering signal associated with spin density excitation. We, for the time being, we call it a disordered phase. I imagine that Shankar and Subir and their collaborators would call it a Kosterlitz-Tauless state. Basically, okay, I guess I probably used most of my time, so thank you very much. Okay, Vladimir asks if the power that I quote is measured at the sample. The power I quote is measured away from the sample. We don't have a power meter inside the cryostat. Typically, the sample will reflect about 50% of that. So the actual power going into the sample is half of that. On top of that, you need most of that power energy. This photon energy is used in creating an excitation across the band gap of the host semiconductor. So the fraction of the energy of that photon that goes into heating of the electron gas is actually much less than the nominal power. Well, if the photon energy is about 1.52 MeV and the gap is 1.5, so out of each photon you get 0.2, you get 10% of the energy into the electron system. And half of it is actually initially reflected by the sample.
Next speaker, a few minutes to be time. Let's see.
About?
Any more questions?
The error bars are getting smaller every year.
Which?
What are you doing?
Actually, one of the things we are doing is, I mentioned before, Mark Erickson is studying actually a number of things, and he's looking into the instability that was predicted years ago by Alan for the Nu equals 2, and these are actually his current data. The data are done, now when you place an angle between the magnetic field and the incident photon, it turns out that you can actually, well, we know that a spin excitation is a triplet, and here's Mark resolving a triplet state. I mean, you have a spin excitation at nu equals 2 that you can actually, because it's a spin excitation at nu equals 2, the system is spin unpolarized, the spin excitations are triplets, and you can actually resolve the triplet. The spacing between the components of the triplet is very close to the Zeeman energy. The thing what I find remarkable about this data is that we believe with Mark that we are activating the Roton minimum. This is disorder-induced scattering. And nevertheless, we can resolve the triplet, meaning that the density of states has to be very sharp. So we are, for instance, this is, and if you plot notice that omega c, the nominal inter-lambda level spacing, is right here. That's where we have a redshift. That redshift is a, you know, the impact of the Roton minimum on the excitation, and Mark has been studying this as a function of density, which is effectively as a function of the R sub s, and it does indeed seem to have a tendency to an instability. What happens is that when you get to real low densities, other things are going on. The system may switch actually to a ferromagnetic state before that instability takes over, but this is very preliminary. So this view, and some of these viewers I will not add to the ones that are going to place on the web because this is unpublished work.
Thank you.
Okay, I first